Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org, and by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargillcreates.com. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Looks like we picked a bad year to give stock markets an extra day to do business. Nobody much cared for the economic news out today, not that that's anything surprising. What you might be interested to know, though, is who's buying and who's selling. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working toward energy independence with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Friday, everybody, February 29th. Great to have you here. You know, that extra day we get every 4 years, we probably could have done without this time around. The stock market fell pretty hard today. The dollar tumbled to new lows overnight. Oil hit new highs. Consumer sentiment plunged to a 16-year low. Hang on, I'm almost done. The Federal Reserve announced yet another big drop of liquidity into the banking system. And to top it all off, the Treasury Department says overseas investors have begun to abandon U.S. stock and bond markets. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
Treasury reports foreign purchases of U.S. stocks and bonds totaled $1 trillion in 2007. Sounds impressive, but that's actually down 12% from the previous year, the first drop in a decade. That caught the attention of Quincy Crosby, the chief investment strategist at the Hartford Insurance Company. She says the U.S. depends on foreign investors.
It always worries everyone. The market takes a deep sigh because when you need that foreign infusion of capital, when the buying is light, you begin to wonder, oh my goodness, is this the red light that it's going to change and change overnight?
Not all foreign investment is leaving. Foreign companies and sovereign wealth funds are taking stakes in private equity firms and other U.S. companies. But Global Insight economist Nigel Gault says the foreign flight from U.S. securities means in the future, credit will be more expensive and Americans will have to rely increasingly on their savings.
The U.S. is going to have to reduce its dependence on foreign capital because I don't think it's going to be as easy to attract the sort of financing that was attracted in the past. And that adjustment will partly be made by the slowdown in growth in the U.S. economy, which is slowing our demand for imports.
The falling dollar is encouraging the shift in foreign investment. That erodes the capital gains foreigners earn from U.S. stocks and bonds and makes U.S. companies and real estate a real bargain. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
It's a fine day here in Southern California, nice and warm, not too much crud in the air, which makes it a good time for the Environmental Protection Agency to wade back into the debate over automobile exhaust. Today, the EPA released its formal justification for denying California's bid to crack down on vehicle emissions. The actual decision, you might remember, came back in December. Administrator Stephen Johnson said today California doesn't have a compelling enough reason to have its own rules. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more now on standards, car makers, and consumers.
automakers would pass the costs of complying with the new emission standards on to consumers. But California says new car buyers would still save money. Cars with lower emissions use less gas. Tom Caquette is with the California Air Resources Board.
Prices will go up as much as $1,000 on the sticker of a new vehicle, and you will save more than $1,000 in fuel within the first 3 years.
But Morningstar auto industry analyst David Whiston hasn't seen any independent studies reaching that conclusion, and he says California's stricter standards would be a costly logistical nightmare for car makers.
You can't have cars coming out of a factory and then being shipped just over to California to meet one set of requirements and then to Texas for another.
Caquette says car makers could decide to make all vehicles California compliant, especially if other states also cut emissions. But Detroit hasn't had much luck with the greener vehicles it's already selling. Even Kermit the Frog struck out with his commercial for the Ford Escape Hybrid.
It's not that easy being green.
Charles Torito of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers says fuel efficiency just doesn't sell.
Last year, more than 53% of all new vehicles purchased in the U.S. were minivans, vans, SUVs, and pickup trucks, even with higher gas prices.
The question is how high gas prices go before consumers decide being green saves enough green. Then the California standards would be moot. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Good students of American history that we all are, we know we laid our differences with Great Britain to rest 200 years ago, right? Well, yes and no, rivalries have persisted, none more so than the one between our respective financial centers. There's always been a debate about whether New York or London is more important to the global economy. A new survey says London has lost some ground lately and that the Big Apple is climbing back on top, and just like in the history books, taxes are at least partly to blame. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports.
Call it a case of insecurity, but London wants to know where it ranks in the global economy. The City of London Corporation is constantly polling 1,200 financial executives around the world. Michael Minnelli conducts the survey.
The trend over the last 6 months was definitely very bad for London. So if we had only used responses in the last 6 months, London would have fallen below New York.
So is the sky falling in London? Hardly. But Minnelli says financial executives are going sour on the city because the government wants to impose a new tax on foreigners.
The number of people are questioning whether or not they'd like to locate in London.
London doesn't have much to worry about. New York may look more appealing right now, but both cities are still way ahead of third place Hong Kong. Jonathan Bowles is the director of the Center for an Urban Future, an economic policy think tank. He calls the rivalry comical.
I do think it's a bit far-fetched that both cities are now starting to panic as if they're losing ground to the other city. It seems like a phony controversy, almost as if it was created by banks on both sides of the pond that wanted to get more favorable tax and regulatory treatment.
Indeed, the City of London Corporation is actively lobbying to scratch that expat tax. And a U.S. counterpart group, the Partnership for New York, started conducting a similar survey last year, too. It's lobbying to loosen visa restrictions on foreign workers. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
It'll be the very sad music today, everybody. We will have the details and the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. Just because both chambers of Congress have approved the new farm bill doesn't mean the dealing's done. Negotiators from the House and Senate have 2 weeks left to work out a compromise between their differing versions. Otherwise, the $280 billion package dies. Lawmakers are trying to figure out how to pay for billions of dollars in farm subsidies and nutrition programs. Jeremy Hobson reports from Washington, the U.S. isn't the only country wrestling with that problem.
While the U.S. economy has been heading south, India's economy has been growing at 8.5%. But it doesn't feel that way to the country's agricultural workers, who make up 60% of the population.
Thousands and thousands of Indian cotton farmers have killed themselves in the last decade, driven by humiliation.
Fred D. Sam Lazaro has made documentaries about India's struggling farmers. He says their shame stems from financial ruin.
The crop is just dried up. We have so much debt, my son-in-law couldn't pay it. I have no idea how we can deal with it now.
That farmer's story is common, and now the Indian government is stepping in. It's forgiving $15 billion of debt for small farmers. Desam Lazaro says voters are demanding a share of the booming economy.
And the politicians, especially during an election season, which is starting up now in India, are going to be mindful of that.
Sound familiar? It should on Capitol Hill, where lawmakers are pushing through subsidies in a huge multi-year farm bill right in the middle of an election season. But Sally James of the Cato Institute says farmers aren't suffering near as much here. Prices for commodities are high and ethanol mandates are paying off.
Things are so great right now. I don't know that farm subsidies are as grippingly important as they would have otherwise been.
But James is certain the bill will get through Congress. The only question is how expensive it will be and whether there will be tax increases or cuts elsewhere to pay for it. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
The State Department said today record poppy harvests in southern Afghanistan are giving the Taliban more money to work with. The crop translated into $4 billion worth of opium. That's the raw ingredient for heroin. The Afghan government officially opposes the opium trade, but illegal or otherwise, it's nearly impossible for the government there to shut down a questionable enterprise. The World Bank says Afghanistan has fewer protections for business investors than any other country in the world, which has made it a magnet for fraud, large and small. Gregory Warner reports.
It seemed too good to be true. Mahbub was 28, with his third baby and a dead-end job in Kabul. And then he got a phone call from a trusted friend with a job offer. The deal was this. If Mahbub would agree to buy a gold coin off a website, sold for about five times its value, then they told him he could make money if he got his friends to buy the coin.
You mean your best friend?
Yes, just bring your best friend.
And again, when his friends signed up their friends. It's the definition of a pyramid scheme. When your business income depends only on signing up new employees, such schemes always run out of joiners. But Mahbub saw his big chance. So he borrowed $1,800, 15 months' worth of salary, and he bought the coin. Then he called up his best friend and his favorite cousin. In this way, a shady internet outfit known as QuestNet, based in Hong Kong and illegal in many countries, has wooed 28,000 Afghans in 2 years. The appeal might be more than quick cash.
QuestNet is not only about money in Afghanistan.
Wissal Zaman used to be a translator for the LA Times, one of the best paid jobs a young Afghan can have. He quit to devote himself to QuestNet.
Because people do make money, but besides money, they learn how to talk, how to speak, and how to love.
How to love?
Yes, how to love, not love girls, I mean love each other.
Zaman is full of slogans about positive thinking and teamwork. Techniques the company uses to obscure the fact that you're taking money from your friends and redistributing it upwards.
They all believe that Afghanistan can be built, and they're the ones who are doing it.
QuestNet scammed thousands in Sri Lanka and Iran before the governments there stopped it. But when earlier this month Afghan President Hamid Karzai announced he was banning the business, Kabul exploded. It's a chilly Sunday morning, and over 1,000 young men are rallying in front of the presidential palace. The crowd is Western-dressed, clean-shaven, more Yankees hats than turbans here.
We have vision. Our vision is a bright Afghanistan.
All the guys here bought the coin. If Quest stops now, they lose. So they wave signs that say, fight corruption, not internet technology. And they shout, Quest Zindagi.
Quest is life.
Quest is Zindagi?
Yes. Life.
Quest, the Hong Kong-based company, is dignity, they shout. Quest is freedom. Quest is service. Quest gives us hope for the future, says one boy, that our government doesn't. The rally didn't work. Government stuck to the ban. But the mood at QuestNet headquarters was victorious. In a room with fake flowers and commemorative coin posters, I watched young men in shiny suits nail up a big QuestNet banner for the local media. And then they assembled on the couch in front of the microphones like some new political party. Wissal Zaman is here. He says he's not going to stop the work.
Governments say what they say, but we do what we do. We believe in what we do.
Though there is one group that seems able to stop Quest. When Zaman's friends came south to recruit in Kandahar, the Taliban left a letter on their door. It said, get out or we'll kill you. And the businessmen quickly retreated. In Kabul, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Thank you. Time to check the week on Wall Street with David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Mr. Johnson, how are you?
Oh, gosh. Shell-shocked.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough.
You know, this was, you know what happened today? This was just, I think it was just the opposite of what happened a week ago today. You remember a week ago today, you and I were talking, and the Dow had been down 250, and it closed up 100, mm-hmm. and it was this, mm-hmm. remember that? Mm-hmm. And you remember the story was going around that they had bailed out, or they'd worked out a way to bail out the big bond insurers, right. which was going to start, you know, at least propping up one or two of the dominoes here or right. there that had fallen down,
yep.
and maybe getting some stability back.
Which, by the way, we're still waiting for.
Yeah, exactly. And that's saying. The problem, is that evidently some sort of a snag showed up in the AMBAC rescue. So I think that was part of it. But, you know, the bad thing is one of those mornings you could see it coming. You get up real early this morning. Those European markets were already getting pounded. You could just see that wave of selling coming here. And so often that happens. You know, we always look for excuses, you know, here in the lower 48 or, you know, between the Atlantic and Pacific mm-hmm. as sort of rocking the whole world. And the fact is sometimes we wake up and we're doomed from the beginning.
Yeah, but I mean, but hold on, because we had your favorite man in the world on Capitol Hill today saying some not so nice things. And you know, I think people are listening, right?
Well, I mean, initially he was saying the right things. I mean, initially he was saying, you know, and I don't think we got a lot of play out of this. He said, I'm more concerned about returning growth to this economy than I am about inflation. And that's a marvelous message and just what we want to hear. And then he sort of casually mentions, oh, well, we may lose a few banks along the way.
Oops.
Oh, golly. And then, I don't know, that was part of it. There was not an enormous increase in volume today. This was just, there were no buyers. They were all sitting on their hands. It was a Friday. And I don't know if we're going to be any better than this Monday, but this was a very unsettling day. Right, there were a lot of rumors out there.
Well, spin it forward for me here. First of all, what rumors are you talking about?
Well, we've heard about hedge funds that are in trouble. Some of these big muni owners, mm-hmm. they buy munis and municipal bonds, and then they buy more because and they use hedges. And evidently, they've been getting some margin calls, so they've been out there selling. You've got the chairwoman of the FDIC having to come back with her response to what Ben Bernanke said about her banks the other day. And she said, oh, well, there's only 76 on the troubled list, and it doesn't amount to more than $22 billion. I know. I felt better after hearing that.
Yeah, lovely, I'm sure. Listen, let me ask you, though. Here we are, let's see, August, September, October, November, December, January, February, March. So tomorrow is March. We are now 7.5 months into this whole shebang, and we still don't really know where we are, do we?
No, we don't. Although, I'm telling you, there's a real good argument. This market should have been, this Dow should have been 9,000 or so. We've had a fairly steady stream of bad news. The optimistic side is that the market sees something we don't. The market is doing what it normally does. It looks ahead 6 months, and it sees a turnaround coming in the economy, and that's why we've been doing as well as we have been.
Yeah, I think you've been saying that for like 6 months, right?
Yeah, it gets me up in the morning.
David Johnson down in Dallas. Thank you, David.
Bye, Kai. Have a good weekend.
I will. Coming up, exploring the esoteric world of conferences.
Last night we were talking about alternate scenarios of history. What would have happened if the Apple III didn't have the technical problems it did and could have run Apple II software?
Wow. But first, let's do the numbers. Ah, the wah-wah trombones. I knew they were coming. The Dow Industrials swooned 315 points today, 2.5% to close at 12,266. The Nasdaq plunged 60 points, 2.5% to finish at 2,271. The S&P 500 tumbled 37 points, 2.7%, ended today at 1334. The week, the Dow gave back 0.9%. The Nasdaq was down 1.4%. The S&P 500 off by 1.6%. For the month that was, the Dow off 3%. The Nasdaq lower by 5%. The S&P sawed off 3.5%. We mentioned that because that was the fourth monthly decline in a row. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Middle East reporting on Marketplace is supported by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org.
Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for February. The National Sleep Foundation opens a conference on the role of sleep in memory and learning. A discussion on napping will take place, but there will be no actual nap time scheduled. And on March 3, 1931, the Star-Spangled Banner officially became the United States anthem. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are a couple of big primaries on Tuesday, but don't tell donors the Democratic campaign is winding down. Hillary Clinton raked in $35 million this month. The Chicago Tribune is calling Barack Obama the $50 million man for his February fundraising effort. So here's a question. If a candidate can manage a nine-figure enterprise, like, say, a presidential campaign, is that good preparation for the White House? Commentator Dan Dresner says the answer is complicated.
As Barack Obama surges ahead in delegates and public opinion polls, Hillary Clinton stresses her 35 years of experience as having prepared her to be commander-in-chief from day one. This raises an interesting question. What is the best experience to prepare the next leader of the free world? The answer is hazy. Some people believe that the executive branch should be run like a business. George W. Bush's MBA, however, does not appear to have imbued him with superior management skills. Businessmen like Mitt Romney, Steve Forbes, and Ross Perot all excelled in the private sector, but all of them spent great sums of money in their presidential campaigns, with little to show for it. Senator Clinton seems to suggest that decades of experience in the Capitol represents the best training for the presidency. Well, maybe. Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and George H.W. Bush were the modern presidents with the longest Washington resumes. Each had their moments, but none of them left the Oval Office gracefully. Washington insiders often rack up accomplishments, but at the same time they possess massive blind spots that cripple their presidencies. Pundits suggest that managing a successful presidential campaign is the best preparation for the Oval Office. This idea is seductive, but tautological. In 2004, experts said Howard Dean was running a brilliant campaign, until he started losing. Politics is too capricious a business to assume the candidates can completely control their destiny through superior planning. As a management question, the problem with being the president is that one cannot anticipate what important issues will arise in the future. No one thought terrorism would be the paramount foreign policy problem during the 2000 campaign. I guarantee you there are issues that will not be talked about during this election year, but will dominate the presidency in 2009 and beyond. Perhaps the best experience to be president, then, is the ability to successfully cope with the uncertain and the unknown. Of course, some managerial experts would not call that experience. They would call it judgment.
Dan Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His most recent book is called All Politics is Global. Give us your thoughts about the financing of this year's campaign. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Chances are that at some point in your professional life, you've been to a conference, long days filled with seminars, workshops, and speeches all tightly scheduled together. But in Silicon Valley, where business has always been run a little bit differently, they've come up with an antidote. We sent Cash Peters to check it out.
Psst! You want to be in on the latest subversive craze? They're called unconferences. It's like a regular conference, only un.
An unconference is a conference, but it's participant-driven, so that there is no predefined schedule or program.
Everybody gets to speak. It's much more egalitarian and flexible and open to whatever comes along.
You're asking the people who are experts in their own right to pick topics and speak.
But how do you know they're experts in their own right? They could just be some guy off the street.
Everybody has an expertise in something.
Well, clearly she's never met me. But there's this whole new subculture going on. Small camps of people with similar interests getting together, but without all the tedious hassle of organization or anyone knowing what the heck's going on. I went to one called Mac Camp for Apple computer enthusiasts.
Yeah.
Actually, those are just sound effects. It was really like this.
To operate at scale and for profit.
The room was almost empty. 75 people registered to come, but only 4 showed up. Kalia Hamilton runs the website unconference.net.
What happens if you hold an unconference
yeah.
and nobody shows up?
Well, then you did a bad job promoting it.
So how would you describe this then?
This?
Yeah.
This was just badly promoted.
Yeah, because promote it well, and 300 to 600 people sometimes turn up. I tell you, it's big. Luckily, there was a better one going on down the street. This other one was called Songbird Dev Camp. I'd prefer it if you didn't ask me why. It's just a bunch of brilliant young software developers enjoying FaceTime together. That's the trendy new term for talking. Talking was all the rage before computers.
The last conference I went to, there was Wi-Fi, but only for the speakers. I actually brought my own access point and plugged it into one of the networking appliances hanging around.
Now you can see why talking died out. On the wall, they had a chart showing the complete schedule for both days of the unconference, and it was totally empty. Organizer, if that's the word, Steve Lau.
This is an unconference. What makes it un?
We've got 3 wireless access points that aren't working. A real conference would have working Wi-Fi.
Is this a bit like dating, but without the romantic element?
We're running a little late, but... I mean, a lot of us know each other from chatting online or email and stuff like that, so it's kind of nice just to get everybody in one room, put a face to a name... Just hang out.
Does anybody ever arrive and you think, oh, God, I wish we never invited them?
Not usually.
Well, it was only noon. There was still time. Anyway, a surprising amount of information gets exchanged. Rains coming.
Last night we were talking about alternate scenarios of history. What would have happened if the Apple III didn't have the technical problems it did and could have run Apple II software?
Oh, darn, I missed that. As you can tell, these camps are a world unto themselves, often with their own lingo. So if you're not in at the grassroots, you could feel a bit left out. Kalia Hamilton, for instance, spoke quite fluidly for the longest time about...
FaceTime and leveraging it in a way that's more useful than that formality of the traditional conference structure.
I have no idea what that means.
The tech culture.
Yeah, but everybody talks in this language, and I don't understand. Nobody... Who knows what you're talking about?
Oh, it's like going to a new country, right?
It is. Baffling nonsense land. In San Francisco, leveraging my 4-gigabyte interface onto a user-driven FireWire platform. Two can play at that game. I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, working to help reduce greenhouse gases with 10 billion transit trips per year at publictransportation.org. By Medtronic, recruiting runners who benefit from medical technology to run in Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon events. More at medtronic.com/globalheroes. And by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, executives at Boeing are going to have a rough weekend. There is word late this afternoon the U.S. plane maker has lost a multi-billion dollar bid to build new tankers for the Air Force. The contract will go instead to a joint proposal from Northrop Grumman and the European manufacturer EADS, who makes the Airbus. Contract's worth almost $40 billion. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow sank 315 points, 2.5%. The NASDAQ dropped 60 points, also 2.5%. The S&P 500 slid down 37 points. That is 2.7%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, dealing with death in Saudi Arabia.
After 3 days, I got one more dead body to handle. And I became a little bit strong. This is the life we have to do.
It's another installment of our series, Working. Also, the Marketplace Morning Report will be live from Cairo, Egypt, on Monday as we begin 2 weeks in the Middle East. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.